Hello, everyone, and welcome to Naughty Doctor Podcast with your host, Money. This is a very special episode because it's the first time that I have a guest here with myself, who I'm going to allow them to introduce themselves.
Hey, I'm Brianne Leeson, and I'm honored to be your first guest.
Thank you so much. So, would you like to tell us about how you help people advocate for themselves, first of all, with your website and your coaching that you provide?
Yeah. So I am a late diagnosed autistic and ADHD adult, and I learned at 30 years old, I'm 32, and now I do peer support coaching. So it is basically, I am the friend I wish I had when I was first learning that my brain didn't run on the software I thought it ran on. And I let them learn from my mistakes and all of the hyper-focus rabbit trails I've gone down looking at research, because my autism loves research. And I am there for them, so I help them really in whatever capacity they need. If they're needing help figuring out a routine that is not based on neurotypical means for them to be able to take care of themselves and deal with their executive function, I help them, you know, if they're about to go into a job interview, and I also help them if they have a doctor's appointment coming up and they're like, I am anxious, they don't treat me well, please help.
Yeah, so hopefully with your experience and like all the people you've managed to meet, you can let us know as like healthcare professionals in development, let's say.
Yeah.
Like my audience and myself, we're in university, so it will be really good to have this perspective, like from someone who's went through it, someone who was in a position who has access to all these different people and their personal experience as well.
And the other aspect is my mom is a retired physician, and okay, my biological dad is a doctor, and I come from doctors, so.
So, let's start with your late diagnosis. How was that like? Was it like frustrating? Did you have to fight for it?
Yeah, the first was the ADHD diagnosis. That's the one I saw some stuff about ADHD, and it was at the beginning of the pandemic, and all of my routines had fallen apart because a lot of them, like taking care of myself, were predicated on me going out and doing things and having people over. Like, my cleaning schedule was based on, this is the day I have people over to play Dungeons and Dragons. So everything, this sort of Jenga tower of tasks to help take care of my needs as a human, had fallen apart, and I was struggling to do everything, like feed myself, do everything. And I was like, there's something really wrong. And I recognized, like, I'm not depressed. This isn't depression. There's no hopelessness. I'm still getting out of bed. It's just, I don't have the mental energy to do the basic things I was doing before, and I didn't understand. So I researched and I was like, do I have ADHD? That would be wild. I had the stereotype that you hear about of the hyper little boy climbing on things and interrupting class. I didn't have the broad idea of, well, actually that diagnostic criteria can look like a lot of different things.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was talking to my therapist about it, and my therapist was like, well, I have ADHD, and I've known you since you were a teenager, and now I feel like I should have mentioned that earlier, because you should go get an assessment. So I was like, all right. So I went to go seek an assessment, where that doctor told me, I don't think you have ADHD. I think you are severely depressed. You say things feel a little hopeless right now. And I was like, we're in the beginning of a pandemic. If you don't feel a little hopeless, you are a serial killer.
Honestly.
Like, there's something wrong with you if you don't. I was like, and I put in the notes that it's the pandemic related stuff that makes it feel scary right now. But anyway, she told me you are, you're self-employed, you have a university degree, you, like, just listing all of my successes as reasons why I couldn't have ADHD, and then pressuring me to go on a medication that I told her, I've been on that medication before, it made me depersonalize. Yeah. Also, I'm not depressed. Like, I know I'm not depressed. But she heavily implied that I would hurt myself. And I was like, no, that's not it. So I got really, really hopeless feeling. After that, actually, she made it worse, because I was like, I just need someone to give me an assessment. Because she asked me, like, 5 questions and didn't give me a full assessment even.
So was this, like, a psychiatrist or, like, family
It was
medicine?
A psychiatrist. A
okay,
psychiatrist.
So they were actually specialized to...
And that's the thing. Being in the beginning of the pandemic, I had to find someone via telehealth, and it was through, like, a psychiatry telehealth thing. And when I went to go look her up later, she specializes in children with ADHD and doesn't actually see adults in her non-virtual stuff. So I was like, why did I get referred to her if she's not going to recognize those traits in an adult?
Yeah, because like a lot of neurodivergent assessments happen before the age of 18. So either doctors just don't get exposed to people above that age, or they just think, oh, this person's fine.
Yeah,
they're
so
doing
like the
okay
rest,
right now, so.
Yeah, the rest of her patients don't have their own businesses and university degrees because they're children, not because we might not have the same neurotype. So after that, I have 2 partners, and one of my partners was like, I am convinced you have ADHD after looking up the diagnostic criteria, after talking about it. He's like, we're going to find you a doctor. So we found a doctor who was doing virtual visits, and he was like, hey, this doctor actually has, as part of this whole intake paperwork, a little mini assessment thing that has the basic 14 question thing on there, just to see if it's worth your time to come in for the assessment. If you want to fill that out, we can see about getting you an appointment. And I filled it out, and I was like, all right, I'm done. And the next morning, I woke up to a call from them going, hey, so we were booked out for a couple weeks, but we would like to see you as soon as you'd like. How's tomorrow? And I was like, what? They're like, yeah, very likely combined type, but we're going to get you your full assessment and get you to see someone. And so, yeah, I got an assessment through that physician who said, you obviously have combined type ADHD, like, very obviously. So, like, I meet all of the criteria.
Oh, okay. And, like, did absolutely no one else, just any healthcare professional, whether, like, it was your therapist or just other doctors in general, did none of them at any point just say, do you want to consider this, maybe, or?
No, and I think especially because of my age, there was so much more of a stigma.
Yeah.
And even from my mom as a physician in the 90s, it was like, well, they just want to get these kids put on these meds.
Yeah.
Like, it was seen a lot of it as misbehavior. And a lot of it, I also do think there's, from what I've been learning, very much a cultural aspect. So I'm mixed ethnicity, I'm white and Latina, and I think a lot of my hyperactive ADHD traits were, and the interrupting and stuff, were considered misbehavior or rudeness or disrespect. So a lot of those, I had gotten sort of trained to not do them from a very early age, so they didn't present as obviously as I think with some others. So no one considered it, because when I did show those traits, it was like, well, you're being rude.
Yeah. That's really unfortunate. And I think being a woman also played a really important role in that as well.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. It's completely different, not only with how am I present with ADHD and autism, but also just the misogyny that all healthcare professionals have towards women is is widespread.
Yeah, that initial, that first doctor who told me I was depressed actually looked at like the stuff I'd filled out for my previous medical procedures and was like, yeah, I see here that you have a blood disorder and you can't have children and you're probably depressed because of that. And I was like, I don't want to pop out a kid. Why do you think I literally, no one mentioned that. No one mentioned that at all. Why do you care? Why are you latching on to that? So after my ADHD diagnosis, I chose to seek medication because I had all these coping mechanisms that weren't in place anymore that helped me function. And medication helped a lot. I think I've described ADHD as it feels like I have 10 TVs that are on in my head at all times, and someone may be adjusting the volume on one of them, so I might be trying to concentrate on reading, and then there's an old episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer they've cranked the volume up on, and I'm like, why am I thinking of that right now? So being on meds, it's like someone turns the volume down on every TV except the one I'm actively needing to watch. They're still there. Like, they're still there. I still hear them. They're not going away, but someone's just turned the volume down some, so it's like, focus on this a little easier.
Yeah, I have ADHD myself as well. I got diagnosed about a year ago, and I just started using Ritalin because it was really hard to get it at first. And I completely understand what you're explaining. It's like your mind just quiets down a little bit and allows you to pay attention to what you want or you need to pay attention to.
Yeah. It's less, I'm less floating around at the whim of whatever thing is the loudest. So after my diagnosis, I was like, the meds are helping. But part of the reason I had sought help was that I was having what I had been told my whole life were panic attacks. But I was having them a lot. And I think being in the pandemic and being at home where I felt safe, I realized in a very autistic fashion, this doesn't fit the definition of a panic attack in the way I've heard it described quite literally with other people. I had just gotten told you have panic attacks and anger issues, which I think again is the misogyny.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know what these are. I was having these meltdowns over things that seemed like nothing. But like, if I told myself I'm going to go have the rest of the pasta for dinner, and one of my partners had finished the pasta, and I go there to go look for dinner and it's not there, yet we have a bunch of other food I could eat. My mental plans had changed, and I would end up screaming and crying on the kitchen floor, and like, to the point where I pulled the handle off of the door to our garage accidentally in the middle of one of these. I am not a large person. I'm a small person, but I like hulked out and I'm like, hey, what's happening here? So I researched, and the thing that got me looking more at autism was seeing a Venn diagram that someone had made of ADHD, autism, and the shared traits.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I have all the ADHD ones. Oh, how funny, I have all of these shared ones. I was like, I don't know what some of these ones on the autism side are, but the ones I do know, I think I might have, except for the social issues. I study social stuff all the time, and I know exactly what I need to study for each situation to understand what I need to do. But looking at that Venn diagram piqued my interest, and I saw the term hyperlexia. And I was like, well, I need to figure out what that is. That's a new word. And that described my early childhood, which presenting these traits in early childhood is exactly what you need to help differentiate autism from a lot of other things. Not ADHD, but autism can get misdiagnosed as BPD, misdiagnosed for PTSD. There are lots of things that can give someone some of the same traits as autism, but they present later in life. So presenting those traits before age of 4 here is where it's important. So looking at hyperlexia, that is precocious reading. Very, very early reading. You can read words, you're preoccupied with letters, but you might not actually understand the full meaning. So I my first word beside mom, like mama, was me saying, "Who is it?" And the phone rang. I just jumped straight to a sentence because in my mind, I was mimicking, which is happening a lot with autism. And at 2, I started reading. And by the time I got to school, I was already reading at like a middle grade level. And I read nonstop. And 84% of children who present with hyperlexia are autistic. So after seeing that percentage, I was like, well, dang. If it's comorbid with ADHD and 84%, I was like, I should see somebody.
Yeah. So after getting the ADHD diagnosis, you had to do the research on your own to see if mm-hmm. you also have autism. So I guess like, do you see that as a failure of the healthcare system as well for your psychiatrist to mention that at any point, have you like just ask you about if you think you have autism or if you have some other characteristics of autism? Because I know both of them are kind of like a spectrum, ADHD and autism, but autism is just a greater spectrum that you can, if you're autistic, you can have a lot of the ADHD traits as well.
Yeah, so about half to 80% of autistic people is the current sort of range of value present with ADHD traits, at least. So half of autistic people have ADHD and about a third of people with ADHD are autistic. Yeah. There was a recent study where they actually found genetic markers for ADHD, genetic markers for autism. They found that they share, I believe it was 5, and then they have like 7 ones that are independent to both. And then people like me who had both had the 7 for ADHD, the 7 for autism, and the shared ones. So in the autistic community, there are a lot of us who are saying, hey, there needs to be some separate consideration for those of us who also have ADHD, because having these two things that are like, it's like that meme, there are two wolves inside of you. mine are fighting a lot because they want opposite things. And when they're combined, it presents very differently. But my psychiatrist for the ADHD diagnosis did a very short autism screener, but it is the one that was written by an allistic person, which if people don't know, allistic just means not autistic.
Yeah.
All of the questions are written by an allistic person, and all of them are written as though you are a parent being asked these questions about your child. And all of them are very much coded to assume your child is a little boy.
Okay.
So they developed this screener only looking at white boys. I believe it was under the age of 8. So when I'm autistic and I'm quite literally reading these things and I'm not just getting the gist of it, I was like, no, I don't have trouble with social situations, because I didn't understand that people who are not autistic just instinctually can move through and understand stuff like phatic communication, which is like where someone says, how are you? And they don't actually want to know how you are. Yeah. It can mean different things that are not how are you. I didn't know that. I was like, I'm great at social situations. I make sure I understand what I'm going into, getting into it. I'll even Google it. I didn't understand that intellectually having to get my way through that social situation was not what everyone else is doing. So when they ask you these questions, meant for a child, meant to be answered by someone else, and without context to say, hey, this is how people's brains work who aren't autistic. So everything I thought were my social skills were autistic masking, essentially. Yeah. So my psychiatrist gave me a test meant to find autism in little boys, specifically little white boys.
Yeah. And that just has to do, I guess, with a lot of just a DSM, I think, in general, which is based on mostly autistic people, at least for like neurodivergency traits. That's usually just for men, developed like 50 years ago, where there was like Asperger's, who was associated with Nazis.
Yeah, was not a registered Nazi, but for listeners, Asperger's was not a registered Nazi, but he did do work for the Nazis where he sent children to be euthanized if he deemed them to not be productive.
Yeah, so those were essentially just autistic children who met his certain criteria of, oh, these people will be useful for us in the future, and the rest doesn't matter.
Yeah. Essentially, if they had a comorbid intellectual disability or they were non-speaking, he was like, you're not going to be useful.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to highlight that now, that us going into healthcare in the future, we need to like take into consideration where a lot of these resources and tests and screenings come from, actually. So, like, we need to first of all ask autistic people, like, get them to voice their opinion, their thoughts, their experiences into creating these screenings, and make sure that it applies to everyone, and to have like doctors who are already educated or like graduated from high school, graduated from a university, to go through these continuous educations and continuous development to know their patients. Like, that's the main point. That's why we go through all this training all this time. It's not just to treat a certain demographic of people.
Yeah. And when I finally was like, okay, I would like to get assessed for autism, trying to find that as an adult is extremely difficult. There were a few places near me that they offered it, but I had done enough research to kind of know what red flags were for a place. So I found local places that also offered a therapy called applied behavioral analysis, which it is very much a nuanced thing, but applied behavioral analysis basically teaches autistic people to mask their traits. It leaves up to 80% of the kids who go through these programs meeting the clinical criteria for PTSD. It does things like use their special interests as reward and punishment. It messes with things like understanding consent, because they'll say, like, give this person a hug, shake their hand, take your jacket off, you can't have your jacket on in here. And just basically the goal of it, the man who created it said the goal of it was to make autistic children as indistinguishable from normal children as possible. And he was also quoted as saying that autistic people are not people in the psychological sense.
That doesn't make sense at all.
Yeah. And the part that is really difficult, it would be really easy to say, just ban ABA then. It's torture. And there's even a place here in the US where there is a device that is 9 times more powerful than a cattle prod, used specifically for punishment, that they use in a group home on autistic people to do ABA type treatment on them. And it is the Judge Rotenberg Center in Massachusetts. And it is mostly black and brown autistic people that go through here. And for things that I do every day, they are being shocked as punishment. And it's legal. It's legal here. So it would be easy to say just ban ABA altogether, but also autistic masking is something that has saved my life in certain occasions, because our autistic traits get met. They get assumed to be violence sometimes, assumed to be anger. And if you're talking about a BIPOC autistic child and their parents are left going, okay, this therapy is harmful to them, but if my kid doesn't learn to mask, they are twice over more likely to be assaulted by police. And they cannot hide the color of their skin, but they can try to hide that they're autistic, because autistic people are also more likely to be victims of police violence. So when you get put parents in that position, it's like, yeah, what do you choose? Like, you want your kid to be alive, what do you choose? And often on health insurance here in the US, that is the only thing that's covered for your autistic kid. There are so many therapies available, but at the base level, most of them offer ABA, and that's the one that'll be paid for. And they do 40 hours a week with these children. And for a lot of these parents, that's the only feasible means of childcare they can find. So it's really a systemic issue, because if we don't dismantle the system that requires these people to, you know, encourage their kids, like, hey, masking is bad for you, but also I want you to be alive. So it's really complex. So a lot of autistic people just say, ban it all together. And I'm like, that would be great. But what do we do with the vacuum you create for these people who are hurting otherwise? But anyway, I digress. I found places, but they offered ABA. And I was like, this place will not be very good. And once again, one of my partners came through and was like, I found this doctor who is autistic herself. And I was like, okay. And then he was also like, I also found some screener tests that you did not take for autism when you did it at the psychiatrist, if you wanted to take them. So I was like, yeah, we'll see. We'll see if it's worth it. We'll see if it's worth getting assessed. I took all of the tests available on the link he gave me. There were like 17. And on every single one of them, I got like, hey, A for autism. like, not just marginally, just yeah. Like, whoa, buddy.
Full on autism.
Yeah. And there was one that there was one of the tests that rated autistic masking traits. And for the listeners, autistic masking, there are a lot of people in the neurodivergent umbrella who want to use the term masking, and like ADHD folks I see use it quite a bit, but that kind of makes me uncomfortable because I think autistic masking is so detrimental to our health that I do think that is a term that we need to not dilute. There's a recent study that showed with it being a contributor to our suicidality rate that intense masking over long periods of time takes up to 14 years off of our lives. And that is suppressing our autistic traits, which doesn't sound very complex, but it is, because my autistic traits are everything from the tone I'm adding to my voice right now, because there's a certain point where if I don't mask by adding tone to my voice and doing facial expressions, autistic people who don't know how to read autistic behaviors will not understand me correctly. Like, it's a necessity to communicate with autistic people who are not used to dealing with an autistic person. But it's changing my posture. It's hiding when I'm uncomfortable, which is a lot of the time, with sensory issues or just all kinds of things can make me uncomfortable or overwhelmed. And it's things like having scripts in my head for all these situations. And like, when I know I'm about to be in a new social situation, it is to the point where my brain just starts scripting it, like I'm running a program in the background, whether I want to or not. Yeah. But it's changing everything about ourselves. And like, I have a lot of clients who mask for so long, they're like, I don't know who I am. It's like they're undercover, and they've been undercover too long, and they've forgotten who they really are, and they don't get a chance to know who they are underneath. So I took all those screeners and my masking was through the roof, and I cried because the questions on the masking test were asking me things that I thought were my social skills. I thought everyone was putting that much effort into every social situation, and that when everyone heard a friend say, oh, I'm fine, their brain had to run through every past interaction they've had with that friend where they say, oh, I'm fine, to do a comparison of them, to see which one they meant, to see, well, are they actually mad at me, or are they actually wanting to do this, or are they not fine, or are they actually fine, or like, what of the million meanings of that does that mean given the past data I have on them? I thought everyone was doing that. So that shook my world. Like, I learned I run on a different software than most of the people that I know. And that was like, okay, I do have to go get my assessment. Like, I do. At that point, I was like, I need to know.
And what did it feel like when you eventually did get your diagnosis and your assessment?
It's really a mixed bag, because you'd think having this answer would mostly just bring relief, but there's also, you go through the grieving process, and I was reevaluating my entire life, now understanding that I'm autistic and understanding what that means. And there are things that weren't traumatic before, but now that I understand, well, that was ableism, or that person was taking advantage of you, or you look at all of the times you needed help and it was an autistic thing and that's why you were having trouble. And doing that for so long, I can't tell you when I'm overwhelmed until it's too much. Because to be autistic, you are in a constant state of overwhelm, especially when you don't know you're autistic and you think that's just what everyone else is doing. So having an answer, knowing you're not broken, you're not bad at being a human, you're just bad at doing things like an autistic person, which makes sense because you're not.
Yeah.
But there's also a sadness, because I had been seeing mental health professionals since I was 4 years old because I was having meltdowns and I was having autistic shutdowns. And yeah, my panic attacks that I was having at the beginning of the pandemic, classic autistic meltdown, just classic. Every aspect of it, everything I did, and nobody ever thought that. They would rather just tell me, it's anxiety, it's a panic attack, and also you're a bitch.
Yeah.
So that's kind of all I got. When it wasn't anxiety, I'm chronically overwhelmed. So yeah, getting that diagnosis, that's the beginning of rewriting your user's manual, because someone had given me the user's manual for a neurotypical, and I'd been trying to use that for 30 years and it didn't work. So now I had to start from scratch and start doing things that most people get a chance to figure out when they're really young kids. And it's really strange, but it's a journey. Like, I'm 2 years out and I've made a lot of progress, but I'm still constantly learning.
So I guess this is like part of the repercussions you were talking about on your website of getting a diagnosis.
And right. those are more legal repercussions.
Oh, okay.
So I had to make the decision, like, I wanted to be a foster parent at some point. And most states here, if you're autistic, you cannot be a foster parent. And there are, like, I am queer and polyamorous in Texas, and I want to get out. But there are different countries I can never immigrate to now, because they do not allow autistic people in, because they see us as unhealthy and don't want us here. And if they found out I'm autistic later, I would get deported.
Yeah. I have no idea that that's the case.
Yeah. There's also, I keep learning new things as it goes, but there are certain places where you might get put at the bottom of an organ transplant list for being autistic, because, you know, you're
How
not...
How does that affect organ transplants at all? It's like...
It's the value that we're seen... It's the value. We're seen to not have as much... to be able to take care of it, or to be as quote-unquote productive. We are seen as a drain on society. So there are certain places like that. I know at the beginning of the pandemic in the UK, there were some autistic people who were having DNRs put on them without consent. And I think there were a couple hospitals there. It was at the very beginning of the pandemic, and I had just learned I'm autistic, and I was like, I don't have the mental space for this right now.
Oh, God.
So yeah, there's so much systemic ableism that if you have a documented diagnosis, there are a lot of things you can't do. That takes a lot of things off of what your options are. So those are things I go through with clients a lot. Like, you can always go get an official diagnosis later, but you can't unring that bell later. Like, you should know for sure. So that's why in the autistic community, going through self-diagnosis is seen as extremely valid, because there are things that it could mess up for your life if you have an official diagnosis. And not only that, but I had to pay $1,100 to get my assessment, and that was one of the cheaper options. I had to pay that out of pocket to get my assessment. Yeah.
And this wasn't covered by insurance?
No,
at all.
Not at all. Not in a million years. So there are huge waiting lists. People who have kids more often have CPS called on them, Child Protective Services, if someone knows they're autistic. If someone gets divorced and there's a custody battle, I have seen a lot of cases where they're like, well, this parent's autistic, so they shouldn't get as much custody because they can't take care of the kid on their own. So yeah, I go through those things with people because I'm like, you can always go back and get it later, but you cannot take that off of your record.
And I want to ask about these labels they give, for example, like low functioning or high functioning, things like that. I personally don't agree with that at all, but I think this plays into that part of just society in general, seeing neurodivergent people less of in any sort of way, as if not being able to talk to someone is considered like a bad thing, whereas you can you have things to say, you know, you can communicate with someone, it just doesn't have to be verbal, for example.
Yeah.
And personally, I don't see any benefit of that in the healthcare setting, but I think like you're not going to treat someone different if they're low or high functioning autism. Anyone who comes to you have to be able to make the environment and setting fit for them, regardless if they're autistic, if they're holistic, anything, if they're physically disabled, mentally, anything that's the case. So there's no reason to give the low and high functioning. But I think that stemming from healthcare professionals has a even greater weight to it to society, because they see us as people who are trusted, I guess, with this really high position, and we just rocket the ableism towards autistic people by using these terms.
Yeah, and ultimately those terms come, I believe it was back in the 80s, where the low and high functioning really first appeared to describe things, and it was determined on how early you spoke, if you did speak, and if you had a comorbid intellectual disability. And to me, it seems weird that you would decide one diagnosis based on whether or not someone had a comorbid one.
Yeah.
Like, it should not, your comorbid intellectual disability should not, you are still autistic. It's still autism and this other thing.
Yeah.
Like, I don't get a special type of ADHD because I'm autistic. I live with them both. They affect each other. So the autistic community very much hates those labels. And even so, like with my diagnosis, I got diagnosed with level one, which has certain criteria, which is just repackaged. But that also looks at your support needs. So on that, for my late diagnosis, it was like needing minimal support, blah, blah, blah. But my support needs are not static. And especially when someone is late diagnosed, there are things that I thought, oh yeah, I do fine doing that. But I actually don't. Like, just because I can do it doesn't mean I should. Yeah. And I learned there are things that I had trouble with that I assumed was the difficulty level everyone was playing this game on, and it was not. So my support needs are much higher than I thought they were when I first got diagnosed a few years ago. But my support needs will forever be labeled as my diagnosis, because that is something that is seen as unchanging in the diagnostic part. So the autistic community has sort of thrown around different terms like high support needs, low support needs, but how do we also say, well, that's not a static thing that can change based on your environment and your age? There's also the terms high masking, low masking. So like, I would be high masking because in a lot of situations, I will mess up, but I can come across as mostly neurotypical, depending on the situation. So those terms have been thrown around. But yeah, I don't think the community has landed on something that we think is really an answer to it. But I think ultimately, if diagnosticians and the medical community in general could step away from looking at, okay, how productive are you going to be to capitalism? Let's base your diagnosis on that, because that's essentially what it adds up to.
Yeah.
Is can this person go work a job and work it well and work it without people thinking they're an autistic little weirdo? Let's make your diagnosis based on that. And it also, for some people, get labeled as low functioning, who are robbed of agency just because they're non-speaking. Just because they have a comorbid intellectual disability. They don't get access to things they would have gotten access to otherwise. And that's really important when they don't get access to things like education and other things that they might really want to do, but they're seen as low functioning, and labeling them that forever robs them of so many things in their life. So I really think the individual human and not their what they can give to capitalism is what you need to be looking at, and not how you deem their functioning. And people assume I'm super high functioning a lot of the time. It's like, okay, well, as a physician, you're seeing me for 30 minutes tops right now, and you're not seeing the 6 hours I'm having to go rest in the dark at home, and I have trouble talking because I used all of my social battery and my energy and everything to go to this one visit. So I think doctors also realizing you are seeing them for a moment in time and not how they function the rest of the time.
Yeah. I think it would be better if doctors just say, oh, this person is autistic. Every time they come to us, the support they need, or like how they want us as professionals to interact with them, can be dynamic. Like, Why can't that be the case? Because out of that, as you say, like, very short period of time that we have to interact with patients, that's just it for us. But anything we add to that autistic diagnosis, if we label with other things, it's not going to benefit us in the way that we treat them, let's say. But when they leave the office, when they leave the hospital, everything else in their life is going to get shifted and changed.
Yeah, and even when it doesn't have to do with autism. Like, even when it doesn't have to do with autism. And that's another thing. The autism spectrum isn't less autistic to more autistic. Which is very much, I have met physicians who think that. It is, the autism spectrum is more like a pie graph. And my different autistic traits, which you'll find in the diagnostic criteria, sensory sensitivities, repetitive behaviors, social differences, eye contact differences, those all have different levels. And each autistic person is going to have their own mix of high and low traits. So you often hear of, okay, this autistic person's nonverbal. I'm at the hyperverbal end of that trait, and I have trouble working something out without saying it. Like, I have to say it or write it out in order to wrangle my own thoughts. And that's the other end of that trait. So the autism spectrum is where we fit, where all of our little sliders are for those different traits. But a person is either autistic or they're not. That's like saying, oh, this phone is an Android, and this phone is an Apple, and this phone is profoundly Apple. Oh my God, it's so fucking Apple. Like, no, it's not. Like, the software is the same.
Yeah.
Might be running on different hardware, might be running a different version of that software, but you're either autistic or you're not.
Yeah.
So I think if doctors understand that autistic people have a different experience of even our own bodies as well, that's where I've come with the most trouble. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding for the way autistic people operate, where we're trying to say, I think I know better than you. And we're not. We have to prepare for things. So when we dump a bunch of information at a doctor to say, this is why I'd like an MRI, this is why I think I'd like to get this blood work done, we're not saying, I Googled it and I think I know more than you. That's not what we're doing. That's,
it's,
we have to give you all
experience.
And we have to give all the context to say, okay, you need to know why I'm bringing up these things that are bothering me and why I think this might be what my issue is, but I would like this test run by someone who knows differential diagnoses and who knows more than me, and like, can we do this? Because I have gone into so many doctor's appointments where I'm like, hey, I'm having XYZ. I think this is what might be wrong, but I obviously don't know. I would love to know what you think, but I would like this run just in case. So many times the doctor sees it as, listen, you don't have that. And they, I know you Googled it and you think you have this and you're trying to diagnose yourself with this. It's like, no, I mean the literal words coming out of my mouth. I mean, I want to get screened for this. It will either say yes, it will either say no. Either way, I've figured something out. Please just do my blood work. Like, you see it and you decide you know better than the doctor. So that's not the case. We have to be prepared. We need the context.
Does that preparedness ever get you into a problem with healthcare professionals? So let's say you're like under a lot of distress, under a lot of pain, but when you go to a healthcare professional because of your need to be ordered and have like show context for everything that you present, did that ever cause a problem for the doctor to just, or like any healthcare professional to just dismiss it as like, oh, you can't possibly be going through that because you're sitting here perfectly fine telling it to me?
Yeah, that actually happened. I was 19. And I really like, one of my biggest stims is like running and working out. And I didn't realize that's where I got my hyperactivity out, but that's one of my big stims. And I noticed like, hey, I'm having trouble breathing, like just getting out of bed. And when I sit up, it's harder to breathe than when I lay down flat. And I started noticing these things. And I was like, I went from running 8 miles a day to having trouble getting up. But I wasn't having any pain that I noticed. I just felt off. And within a couple months, I had gained 40 pounds and I hadn't changed what I was eating. And I went to a doctor and I was like, I think something's seriously wrong. Something feels off. I'm trying to do my normal workouts and I can't. I've gained all of this weight in a very short amount of time. And it just, when I try to go run, my chest feels kind of tight and my heart rate is fine because I was worried I was having some sort of cardiovascular issue. And I was like, I don't know what's wrong. I really would like to get my lungs looked at. I would really like to get some blood work done or something because I shouldn't be gaining this amount of weight. And the doctor was like, you're having trouble breathing because you gained a bunch of weight. The chest feels a little tight, but that might just be because you're out of shape. And I was like, 2.5 months ago, I was running 8 miles a day. Like, something's wrong. And because I didn't describe pain either, because one of the senses, aren't just the taste, touch, sound, smell. There's also interoception, which is how your brain and your body communicate with each other, basic body cues. So for a lot of autistic people like me, my interoception is very low. I do not know I'm hungry until I'm having stomach cramps or reflux because I was hungry hours ago and my brain didn't get the memo that that's what my body was feeling. And I have to set myself alarms or I won't eat. And that also plays into my pain tolerance. I often don't know I'm in pain or that the sensation is pain until it is excruciating. So sometimes I just feel off and that might mean that, oh, something hurts. So yeah, I wasn't describing pain. So several weeks later, I was, you know, breathing and feeling like this stabbing pain when I'd inhale. And I was like, that's really bad. and it was getting pretty intense, enough that I was in knew I was in pain, and I went to the ER, and they were like asking me a bunch of questions, didn't believe me when I was like, no, I don't smoke. They're like, you don't, not even a little. And I was like, no. They're like, have you been sick? And I'm like, well, I've not been feeling great, and I tried to get help for it, and I'm really hurting though, and it's when I breathe. Could we do something? And they were like, well, what's your pain at? And I was like, 8, 9, very bad. And they laughed at me. They laughed at me, and they pointed to the, what is it, the Likert pain scale. I was like, you would be screaming and crying if it were an 8. You wouldn't be talking to me, you'd be wailing, and you were making jokes, and you're not an 8. I think it's pleurisy. And I was like, well, that, I don't have any of the other things that might cause pleurisy. Like, why are you saying it's that? I haven't had an infection, I'm very active, I'm not smoking, I don't have an upper respiratory infection at all, like, why are you all saying it's pleurisy? And they sent me home. And then after laughing at me and sending me home and gaslighting me into thinking maybe it is in my head, maybe I'm overreacting, 6 weeks later I woke up coughing and I was covered in my own blood, and I was like, I don't know what's wrong. And I called my mom, and she asked me very calmly, like, does it feel better when you lay flat? And I was like, yeah, actually quite a bit. And she's like, okay, I'm gonna need you to call an ambulance. And I was like, it's probably not that bad. It's not that bad. And I was gaslighting myself. So I was like, called my grandma. I was like, can you drive me to the hospital? She drove me to the hospital, where I very quickly, between my coughing and I had thrown up too, I passed out in the waiting room of the ER. I couldn't see anything, but I could hear and feel things. And I could hear, and I know this is my autism now, I recognize the voices of the nurses that had dealt with me 6 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I could hear those nurses, and they were like, oh yeah, she was in here 6 weeks ago complaining of pain, wanting something for pain. And I was like, bitch, no, I was not. I was asking, why am I in pain? Make it stop. But then I realized, oh, they're treating me like I was just wanting to get drugs. Yeah. So then they went, oh, I think this might be a drug overdose. So my nail beds were blue. I couldn't see. I could hear everything. I could feel them cutting my shirt off of me. And this is one moment where I hated having the level of medical literacy I have, because hearing them talk about my vitals, I was like, oh, that's not good. Oh, that's not good at all. Oh, damn. What are you doing? And finally, the doctor who had said it's pleurisy came in, panicked, and said, hey, not a drug overdose. Not a drug overdose. And, like, they got me stabilized, and as soon as I woke up, they got me in for a CAT scan with contrast, and I had had saddle embolism that looked like it had split up, and I had some clots in my lungs. And I had been sitting on these pulmonary embolisms for over a month. Wow. And the thing that had changed was I had been put on a new birth control back before those few months before I had gained all that weight and stuff. So it was an awful time in the hospital trying to figure out why an otherwise healthy 19-year-old had clots. It wasn't until I got out and my mom sent me to her hematologist friend that it turns out I have a genetic clotting factor. I have factor 2. Clotting condition, which is not the more common one, but I was the first one my hematologist had diagnosed. but with my clotting condition, I can't be on any sort of exogenous hormones, especially estrogen, because they can affect my clotting factor. So yeah, that people not taking my pain seriously, thinking that I wanted something I didn't want, because I mean the literal words coming out of my mouth. There is no subtext, there is no agenda. Yeah. I'm just saying what I mean. So I really did just want someone to answer why I'm in pain. I wasn't trying to get pain medication. Yeah. I bring all this extra information to say, hey doc, this might be helpful. I'm not saying I know more than you. I'm saying here's as much of a picture as I can give you as the person who lives in this body.
Yeah. I'm really sorry you went through that. It's like, I can't believe why anyone would not take anything that you said seriously at that point. It's, to me, it's just wild. Like, that should not have happened at all.
And the fact that that first doctor, the very first doctor, when I said, something is wrong, my body is not operating the way it should at all, I wasn't listened to. And that first doctor should have said, let's make sure nothing is really, really wrong. So autistic people, we show pain differently. We're going to show up to appointments differently. And when I give people tips for appointments with doctors, a lot of it is honestly just kind of bullying a doctor if they're going to be an ass, really. Not calling any names, but basically like, hey, I'm concerned about this, and I'd like to see if I could have a couple tests run because of it. And if the doctor is like, you don't have that, blah, 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 I was like, all right, we're going to turn on their fear of being sued and say, so would getting these tests be detrimental to my health? No. So you're telling me that you are refusing to screen me for XYZ or run this test outright and not because of any medical reason. And they usually get panicked and they're like, I'd like you to write in my chart that you're refusing to do my request for an MRI or a CT or something. I want you to write that in my chart. And usually they get panicked because you're creating a paper trail so that if you go to another doctor and they find something wrong, they would get sued because they refuse to. Yeah, so usually just being a stinker and saying, all right, you're not going to do it. Write it down. I want to see you write it down right now.
That's good. Everyone should do that to all doctors who don't listen to them. Yeah. And it's like they're not paying for it. It's like they're not the ones who are doing the test. Yeah. Why not? Like,
it's an ego thing. I really think it's an ego thing, because when people come in saying, I would like this done, a doctor who has gone through a lot of work, so much work to get where you are, but there's a hubris where it thinks, well, I must know better. And by you coming in and suggesting you think you know what it is, you're saying you know more than me. And it's like, no, I'm not. Chill out. It's really not that deep. Just chill the fuck out for a second. I live in this body and you don't. So I'm giving you information.
If I was a doctor like that, I would be very happy to get patients who come to me with information that they have, because that's just making it easier to know.
Yeah.
Like where to start, at least.
That's how I see it. And like when I have a client for coaching who's like, hey, I tried this thing you suggested. Here are my notes for what didn't work. Here are my notes for what did work. And I don't think this is a good suggestion. And I'm like, cool. All right. You're living your life. I'm not. Let's tweak things. And I think if more doctors just treated the person in front of them and not their assumptions they have of a diagnosis and the things written on a chart, like, it could save autistic lives, because so many of us, I am not unique in my story. I am not unique in my story at all. Like, autistic life expectancy is only 36. And
that's unbelievable.
Yeah. And our second leading cause of death is self-harm. And there are several comorbid health conditions that we can get that leave you in pain too. So when the doctor you go to try to find help is not treating you or even seeing your pain or acknowledging it, yeah, that definitely contributes to an autistic person's tendency for self-harm. And it directly contributes to why our life expectancy is only 36.
I'm sorry, honestly, I don't know.
No, it's a lot. Yeah, it's a lot.
It's, but these are like really important things to consider for all, not just healthcare professionals, for everyone, you know, just anyone you interact with, you need to be able to acknowledge what they're saying at the very least.
Yeah, I think my degree is in linguistics, and I think the big general rule I give autistic people, that if I could boil it down to it, is don't assume, and don't assume the worst. So there is a term called a thin slice judgment that people do, and it's basically where you look at someone, you look at a situation, you filter it all through your cultural, societal constructs and all of these things you've picked up, all of these different mental paradigms, and within 6 seconds you make a judgment call. It's like a snap judgment. Yeah. They've done studies of autistic people seeing video of autistic people. And in the study, it was some people were autistic, some weren't. And they asked them after the study to give their thoughts on the people on the video and if they would be friends with them. More often than not, the autistic people said they wanted nothing to do with the autistic person. It is often assumed we are rude, and people filter all these biases, which are just biases of our disability, which they don't realize. Yeah. And decide they don't like us. They don't know why, they just don't. So I think instead of assuming the worst, say, hey, why is this person setting off red flags for me? Stop and say, what am I seeing? They're being very literal. They're not adding a lot of tone in their voice. Maybe they're not being rude. Maybe that's just how they are. What are the actual words they're saying? And just stop, just pause. Breathe, evaluate the human in front of you and not assumptions, and then keep going.
Yeah. I think that's everything I wanted to ask, I guess. And thank you so much for like all this insight that you give us. It's so important that we hear it from people themselves about what they go through, so we can be just a little bit more empathetic or like understanding mm-hmm. of their position. And that might just help them like in the smallest way, just by acknowledging that people are different, first of all, not just autistic and autistic. People are just different. They have different experiences.
Yep.
And the more we try to view the patient as a person who comes to us rather than a case or a disease, it's going to be better for just everyone in general.
Yeah, yeah. All around.
But yeah, if there's anything you wanted to mention yourself about your own podcast that you host, or anything else.
Go ahead. My show is actually an audio drama, and it's a full cast. I write it, I'm one of the voice actors on it, and we have a composer and everything, and it's called Today's Lucky Winner. It actually has an autistic lead character and an ADHD lead character who I voice. It is a supernatural comedy. It's very queer, very chaotic. It's been called Stoner Buffy. And I actually have an episode that comes out, I don't know when this is coming out, but mine comes out on February 1st, where the autistic character gets the ADHD character stuck inside her brain. So there's like a simulator for you to see what it's like to be autistic and have ADHD at the same time. But yeah, that's my podcast, Today's Lucky Winner. And then if anyone related to my autistic trait stuff and is like, oh, I do that, I have my website, AudiHDBRI, AUDHDBRI.com, where I offer peer support and coaching, and yeah, just a sounding board whose brain soup is a similar recipe as yours to help you out. I've done all sorts of things to help people, and you can find me on TikTok and Twitter at the handle Hot Sauce Ghost, and on Instagram at Brianne_Leeson.
I'll put all of these in the description as well, so people can find it easily. But yeah, thank you so much, Brianne. I really appreciate the time that you gave to talk about your personal experience, and hopefully to everyone who is listening, they'll be more considerate and understanding towards autistic people and people with ADHD, just neurodivergency in
humans,
general.
Humans, yes.
But yeah, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.